Hello and welcome to Wildfire Matters, the podcast that will cover all aspects of wildland fire management. We get behind the scenes to talk with people who dedicate their lives to the profession to manage and protect our public lands. My name is Carrie Bilbao. I'm a public affairs specialist for the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, at the National Interagency Fire Center, or NIFC, located in Boise, Idaho. I will be hosting the series along with my fellow colleague, Jennifer Miss Libby.
Thanks, Carrie. Looking forward to our first podcast.
Yes, between the both of us, we have over 58 years of fire experience.
That's a lot of years enjoying the great outdoors and playing in the dirt.
Yes, it is. And a lot of stories to be told there.
For sure.
Today, to kick things off, for the first podcast, we are talking with Grant Beebe, BLM Assistant Director for Fire and Aviation. Grant leads the largest and most complex fire program within the Department of Interior, or DOI, and get prepared for a lot of acronyms during this podcast. The BLM represents 61% of DOI's fire-related workforce and is directly responsible for fire management on more than 245 million acres of public lands, predominantly in the western United States and Alaska, where wildfire is prevalent across much of the landscape. Welcome, Grant, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Carrie. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Welcome, Grant.
Thank you.
Hi. So first off, we want to hear a little bit about yourself and your fire career. So how did you get started working in wildland fire?
Well, that's funny. You guys said 58 years between you, and I thought, oh, God, I almost got that myself. Oh, my God, I'm old. I'm out of here. So I started in the early 80s. I'll just leave it there. I was a college student. Like many firefighters, I started kind of on a part-time seasonal basis. And so I was trying to pay for books and room and board. And I got a job fighting fire in the summers in Northern California. And, you know, happens to a lot of people. I kept fighting fire in the summers, and I kept going to school. And then finally the balance of power shifted, and I realized what I was doing in the summers was way more fun than what I was doing in school. So, gosh, I pivoted, went to grad school, kept fighting fire, and turned into a full-time fire person by the late 80s. And here I am, several decades later, still in fire.
So what positions did you hold early on?
Oh, goodness. Yeah. So in the early days, I was on a hand crew. Those are typically groups of 20 people who go out and dig fire lines. And I'll just say that a lot of the stuff we talk about in firefighting, it hasn't really changed in the many, many centuries that people have been managing fire. People still dig fire lines in many cases. So we were digging hand lines back in the early 80s as a 20-person crew. I went from that to smoke jumping. I had a boss who used to be a smoke jumper. So a smoke jumper is an initial attack firefighter who typically parachutes into remote fires or fast emerging fires. He had been a smoke jumper for the BLM at one point, and he said, you know, you should give that a try. And I did. So I came to Boise in 1990 to be a smoke jumper. Eventually, took a break there, went overseas, went to Indonesia for a couple of years to do some fire management work overseas. And then came back to the United States and took over the smoke jumper base. Long story short, had some kids, wanted to quit risking my life and being on the road all the time, or risking my life there as opposed to risking my life in Boise traffic. That's a different matter. So I stopped risking my life on the fire line and tried to stay at home and help raise the kids. And so I moved into management, and there you go. Budget, planning, blah, blah, blah. People kept retiring. I kept taking their place. And here I am as the assistant director. It's an honor to have this position, I got to say. But it's a big responsibility also.
Yeah, a long haul. And you've done a lot to get here.
A long haul, true.
It just shows you, if you start in fire, it can take you many different places.
It just shows you can outlast everybody. Just hang on.
Keep going.
Yeah, yeah, that time in Indonesia sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it was. So that was back in the late 90s. And I went to work for the German government, German development agency. Somebody I knew somebody, said, hey, you should try this. My wife and I looked at each other and said, well, that sounds pretty fascinating. So we went to the island of Borneo, actually a place where they're going to now locate the capital of Borneo. So it's called Kaltim, so the east side of Borneo. And we were there for a while working on rainforest fires, kind of an emerging nation issue there right around the tropics. And, you know, claim to fame, I went there and we had the biggest fire year ever in the tropics. So I don't know. I don't know if I get credit for that or what.
That's good timing.
It was an amazingly bad year.
Well, and now here you are.
And here I am. Yeah, and we're having bad fire seasons exactly. here. Maybe somebody should tell me something. Yes. It's time for you to move on.
No, you do a great job, and we love to have you leading us. And you do lead the fire program here for BLM at NFC on the national scene. First question, as one of our 8 partner agencies based at NFC, tell us about wildland fire management and why all these agencies are based in one location.
Yeah, that's a great question. So NFC, the National Interagency Fire Center, used to be BIFC. So anybody who's been around Boise for a while knows that. And BIFC was formed mostly between the BLM and the Forest Service and the Weather Service. Those are common agencies back in the 60s who said, hey, you know, we got this common mission, let's co-locate. And it was more of a local enterprise then, but it evolved over the years into this multi-agency center. I think the concept behind NFC is that fire obviously knows no boundaries, right? So fire grows according to where it wants to grow, not according to whose land it's on. So some of these really, I'd just say path-breaking, groundbreaking leaders back in the day realized that, you know, this is a national kind of problem that we're dealing with when we have wildfires that are burning where we don't want them to burn. So we need a multi-jurisdictional, cross-agency, all partners kind of approach to it. So that's why NFC enjoys the success it has. You know, all those partners are up there at NFC, and you mentioned all 8 of them. There's a bunch of DOI agencies, the Forest Service, Department of Defense. We all realize that we all have to marshal our forces together to fight fires, to manage fires when we need to. And so we don't really pay attention to whose land is burning. It's just really something we call closest forces. You manage the fire you got. It doesn't matter whose it is. You just send what you need, share, because nobody individually has enough resources from the state of Idaho to the state of Oregon to the state of Washington to the federal government. Nobody can afford all the resources they need to fight the biggest fires. So we all share. So the National Fire Center here up at the airport, if people have ever seen the big flame on the top of the tower when they're coming into land or taking off at the airport, that's the fire center. It's, you know, 50 to 60 acres up there. It's been there forever. And we try to do that. We try to share resources and send them where they're needed, regardless of whose fire it is, whose land is burning. We send the resources we need, and then we worry about the paperwork later. It's a huge success. It's been emulated across the world. It's been emulated across government. It's the way government should work. We're incredibly proud, and I think everybody in Boise who's listening, hopefully we got some local listeners, should be incredibly proud that they live in the city where this fire center exists.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts going on there and a lot of coordination and cooperation and partnerships. And to go along with that, you did this international program in Indonesia. Indonesia, right?
Indonesia, yeah.
Yes. But there's also, we move wildland fire resources to other countries as well. So which countries have we supported in the past? And
that's an easy one. You're throwing me softballs here. So some of the key ones people are probably familiar with. Australia is one of our key partners. Canada, even more so in Canada before Australia. Mexico. But I'll say those are probably the top three. But we've got firefighter experts who go all sorts of places, especially to do things like training and work on policies and standardized approach. So this whole thing that I talked about with NFC and the interagency approach, we've exported that. So we have trainers and advisors who go all sorts of places. But Greece can burn, Portugal can burn, Spain, France. Everybody who pays attention to the news has seen those kind of fire seasons happen, and we will often send advisors or aides to those countries. Australia is a big one. We get help from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa very frequently, mostly because there's not a big language barrier, so we can bring people over and we can mesh them into what we call our incident command system really easily. They train on the same standards, and then we go to their countries when they need help, and we fit into their systems as well. So I actually got to go to Australia back in, 2003, the first time we actually sent crews. We sent crews there for the first time back then. They were having a big fire season, so I got to go down there and take a crew of 20 in the Australian fire season. Spent 30 days down there, and I got to go down the year after that. But we have Australians come here often, and New Zealanders especially, and Canadians, really to plug into our incident command system to provide things like what we call division supervisors or helicopter managers, people who help manage other resources. They're really kind of a force multiplier for us. Incredibly great resource. And that's that same concept that we talked about within the United States borders applied across the world. Nobody across the world has enough resources as well. As we're dealing with climate change and global warming. It's kind of a global, it's a global approach to managing fires as well. It's incredibly gratifying.
And Jennifer actually worked in Australia in 2019 when they had that really bad fire, one of their worst in history.
Yes.
And we're seeing more and more of that. So sharing resources across international borders is becoming more prevalent. Of course, we had a little lull during COVID.
I'll say one of the benefits of that is that when you go to another country, I mean, we trained in the same systems and the same sorts of policies, but every country does things a little bit differently. So as Jennifer knows, as I know, you go to Australia and you actually recognize some amazing things about the way they fight fire that we've tried to import back into our country, for instance. And they do a great job with volunteers. They're not nearly as serious as Americans are, I'll say that. They're way more relaxed. And we tried to take on some of the cultural and institutional knowledge that they have to improve our program. So that's one of those benefits of international programs. They come here, they learn some stuff we do really well. They learn some stuff with Asia to Avoid, and we do the same thing when we're in Australia. One of my greatest stories from Australia was I had this crew of 20, and this was the first time, I told you, it was the first time we'd ever gone overseas with a crew like this. And so the people in charge, I was not a big boss then, I was a minor league boss, and they told me, don't screw up. This is the first time you're going overseas with a crew like this. We're giving you a bunch of hotshots and smoke jumpers and engine people, you know, all these people are, because we're supposed to fight fire. These are not managers. You're gonna go there to fight fire, but don't screw up. Otherwise, we'll have a major international incident on our hands. Okay, what could possibly go wrong? So we were, you know, lockstep, you know, keep every hair in place, don't have any fun, blah, blah, blah. And we went to this one fire camp, and it was in the paddock. Sorry, I'm going to throw some lingo at you. In the paddock behind a pub. And the Australians would retire to the pub after the shift and, you know, have a beer and have a chat and you know, basically, you know, socialize after work. And we don't do that in the United States. We you know, don't mix alcohol with our fire camps at all. And finally, somebody told me after about a week that we made the impression that we were stuck up because nobody on our crew would go to the pub, right? Because we had told them, by God, don't you set foot in the pub. Well, I finally had to order people to go have a beer with the Australians because they think we're really stuck up Americans. And so that was the first time I ever got to order somebody to go have a beer. But it was just one of those things. You had to learn the culture, and we were perceived as being, you know, arrogant folks. They actually have an acronym. It's called Fig Jam. And I'll just leave it at that. It's
let people something, figure that out.
Yeah. Something I'm good. Just ask me. And so they were applying it to us. So we quickly had to pivot culturally and say, all right, we got to fight fire like Australians now, or else we'll never be invited back. So there you go.
Well, you must have made an impression because they invited, what did we have, almost 300 people go over in 2019.
Yeah, either that or they're so desperate and they never turn us down.
Yeah, they called us IMTs out there, incident management teams, to help support their fires there. And it was definitely a learning experience. I went over there as a public information officer, and that language on different wording, definitely be careful on that as well.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah, different words mean different things
yes,
from here over
yes,
there. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, aside from that, we'll get into some serious stuff now.
Good luck on that.
Yeah. People wonder, you know, what are the most critical wildland fire management issues today? In other words, what should people care about and why?
So the issues we have today have been longstanding issues. I'll tackle a couple of them. One is the intrusion of the wildland-urban interface into what used to be either rural or forested landscapes. So this has really been exacerbated by the pandemic, but people are living in places where they never used to live. We have communities going up close to wildland fuels, intermixed with wildland fuels. We have people moving into areas that used to be rural who have an expectation that they're going to live in the woods. So maybe they want to maintain a certain landscape around their house that might be heavily wooded. So we have this intrusion of homes into places where they didn't used to be. And those of us who are managing fires have to often protect the lives in the homes at the expense of other resources at risk, right? So that's been a huge problem. It's been growing over the years. It's really been exacerbated by the pandemic, where people now find they can work wherever they want, which is a great thing and a bad thing, because people are living wherever they want, and they have this expectation that we're in the wildland fire services, or like a fire department, and you know, you ring the bell and we'll come save your house. it's more easily said than done. So that's an issue. Global climate change, you know, is undeniable. Global warming is undeniable. We have vegetation that's more drought stressed. We have fuels conditions that are changing, that forests that are turning into rangelands that are turning into grasslands that are turning into exotic invasive grasses like cheatgrass. So we have fuels changes that are going on. We have fuels that are drying out that are becoming more available, and we have fire seasons that are lengthening. So think about your favorite ski hill if you're a skier, and think about how many fewer ski days you're getting these days than you did when you were a kid. I think all of us remember that. Oh my God, when I was a kid, it used to snow all the time. It doesn't seem to anymore. So that laid out across the continent is an incredible challenge. We have less snowpack. It comes off the hills sooner. The fuels that are underneath that snowpack, the forested landscapes, the rangeland landscapes become available to burn earlier, and they burn later. And we have fire seasons that are lengthening, and we have fires that are growing to enormous size, way more large fires on the landscape than we used to have. It's not because we in the fire business are worse at our jobs than we used to be. Frankly, it's because fires get up and go way more than they used to, and we're having a hard time keeping up. So those are three big things: vegetation change, people living where they didn't used to live, and seasons that are longer with more intense fire activity than we've ever seen before. Fire behavior has changed immensely. So you used to dig a fire line next to a fire and try to contain it. Nowadays, we have fires spotting across the Columbia River Gorge, for instance. That is not the fire landscape I grew up with, and I think there are very few people now who really recognize this fire environment we're working in. We have you know, million-acre fires routinely now. The fires I grew up with when back in the early 80s, when I was, you know, learning to fight fire, you know, the big fires we talked about were 100,000 acres, 50 to 100,000 acres, and we would talk about them in awe. These days, a 50,000-acre fire barely makes the news. That is a different environment than we've had before. So going along with that, and we can hit on this a little bit more, but we have this whole workforce that's really tilted towards this view that fire season is a temporary summertime thing. So we've got this temporary firefighting resource that you know, is mostly college kids or high school kids trying to make some money, or people who are just doing it as a part-time job, and then they go work on the ski hill in the wintertime. We got a fire environment that demands us to really change our game. So on the federal side, for sure, and on the state side, we're trying to hire more permanent staff, to have people who are available longer, who can actually be in it for the long haul, who will stick with us and make a career out of it, because it's not something we can handle with a temporary workforce very well anymore.
Right. And along those lines, we're going in. We've recently changed how we term fire season to fire year, because we are longer. Mm-hmm. And some places geographically, some states are burning year round, like California. We know Florida right now is burning, and they may have a couple different seasons in different states, but nationally it seems like we're busy year round.
Yes.
And so it is definitely an issue, and we talk about that, the transforming the workforce because of the year round activity. Can tell us a little bit more about it and why it's so important?
Sure. Let's go back to the fire year concept. So when I was growing up, you were a firefighter in the summer, and then maybe you were a forester or a range conservation person in the wintertime. That was your day job, right? And that was the view of fire. Everybody would just drop their day job and go fight fire in the summer. For a long time now, we've recognized we need more professional folks whose job is full-time fire. What we think is that firefighters, we still have a peak fire season in the West. So peak fire season will stretch from the Southwest is really kind of going into fire season right now, right? So New Mexico, Arizona, their fire indices are going up, and they're starting to have fires. And the plain states like Texas, they're burning right now. So this is March, early March, and they're into their fire season. Fire season moves north and west as the months go, and so we'll move into the Great Basin states soon, and then it'll be into the California, the Pacific Northwest, and the Northern Rockies, and Alaska is in there somewhere. Usually in May, Alaska starts burning. And then we cycle back, and we go to the Southeast in the fall. So we've got this workforce that really needs to travel and follow that peak fire season as it goes, because, again, as I said before, nobody has enough firefighting resources. So the firefighters we have need to be mobile, which means many of them need to be available starting in March and go in all the way to October or November. On the flip side, we also have all this fuel, we call it wildland fuel, that needs managing. So we realize that we have not been aggressive enough, especially on the federal side, of managing our wildland fuels. We need to do way more hazardous fuel reduction, we would call it, or fuels management work, you know, double what we used to do, which also means that some of those firefighters need to be on later and longer to help us in that fire management work, because we need that same workforce to help out on that. Then you throw in Australia or Canada or Europe and these international incidents that also demand some expertise. And so now you're talking about firefighters who really need to work, you know, this whole fire season and all this fuels management work. And then they maybe, you know, need to be available for other emergencies to respond to national emergencies. And then there's international work that needs to happen. And then, by the way, people actually need to see their families and, you know, if they want. See their families, have some time off, and then do some hiring and get ready for the next season. So it's an incredible stressor that we're putting on people. We're trying to keep people in the business. We're trying not to burn them out. So we really want to make them more professional so they can take some time off, for goodness sake, see some loved ones, get away from the office a little bit, get away from the woods a little bit and relax. It's a whole mindset change that we're really trying to push on America, right? So this requires more resources. It requires we really commit to seeing fire as the crisis that it is. I mean, it goes part and parcel with what's going on in the climate. But we have to manage it. We can't just sit back and say, well, okay, fire's going to burn. We'll figure it out eventually. We got to figure it out now.
Yeah, and as we've seen in the last couple of years with some incredible fire behavior, like you were saying, that you've never seen before, the Marshall Fire that occurred in December, kind of some unprecedented issues there that they haven't dealt with before. And so, yes, we do realize we need to change our workforce. And yeah. I know when I started, it was... I worked June to September and then did the ski area thing.
Yep.
We used to also say that the wintertime was when we decompressed. We got our crews back together, you know, did our training, got ready for the next fire year or fire season then. And now it just kind of all comes together.
Right. And I think, you know, we'll probably get to this. So we're working full time to try to bring more resources to bear on the issue. Now, on the flip side, what can the public do? That Marshall Fire is a great example. So what the public needs to do is to have reasonable expectations of what's going to happen when their fire is imperiled by fire. If you've got a house, if you've got a cabin, if you've got some property that you're trying to protect, you need to manage your own fuels on your own ground, which means reduce some hazardous fuels, and then harden your house. So what people know, or they should know, is that all the fire management in the world doesn't help if your house is receptive to a spark that lands on it. So anybody who needs to know anything, just Google it, say, how do I harden my house against wildfire? And those are the responsibility of individuals, of families, of people who own properties. They have to manage their own risk, because there's no way firefighters can keep a fire from spotting, from sending up spots that are going to fly a mile and land on your deck or land on your exposed soffits or land in the wood pile that you have stacked up against the side of your house. There are some common sense people, and I'm a cabin owner, so I'm speaking to myself here now, and I'm reminding myself of all the stuff I need to do this spring, because I'm not caught up yet. But you need to protect your own property, because that is key for property loss. And then you need to obey evacuation orders. You need to get away and, you know, not go down with the ship. Leave your property. Property can be replaced. Your house can be replaced, but your life can't. And so listen to folks when they say it's time to get out. Don't try to be a hero. That's my other bit of advice.
Yeah, as in any natural disaster, have that evacuation plan. Have a plan to have to leave. Know what you're going to take with you.
And don't wait to manage the fuels to the last possible second. It's like, oh, I'll cut those trees, you know, if we get a fire. Guarantee it's too late if you're waiting until the smoke shows up, you know, on the next ridge over from your cabin. So you got to get ahead of it. Yeah. And it's fun. Go fire up a saw. And you know what? It's a lot more fun than you think. But you can't wait till the last minute. And I think people trying to manage, you know, a pristine landscape, that's a great thing. But know that in the middle of summer, those trees that look really lovely, you know, when they're moist, look like a threat at other times. So you got to use common sense. And there are some great standards out there for how to manage your properties. But people can do a lot of things to make sure that their house is the one that survives. Every time a fire burns through a subdivision, you'll see, look, this house made it. nine times out of 10, it wasn't by chance. It made it because people did the right thing ahead of time.
Right. And then a lot of times you get your community involved and you can make it a community effort because it does take a village, basically. One person doing the right thing isn't going to necessarily save their home because of the other properties around them maybe aren't doing the right thing. So
absolutely. And let's say there are a lot of resources out there now to help people manage their property. Congress just passed the bipartisan infrastructure law last year. And in that infrastructure law, there are a lot of grants available. There were a lot of funds available for community protection, for communities to really take on their own protection. And so, you know, people who are members of HOAs or who have communities that do that kind of thing, I think probably are hip that there are a lot of resources that could be brought to bear. It's not necessarily just on their plate. There are a lot of government entities trying to help people help themselves right now because it's a national emergency, and so the nation is really kind of bucking up.
Yeah, and I know we had funding to do some more fuels management, but that's on federal lands. But private property owners can look for those grant funds, as you were saying, and also there's a lot of contracting companies out there. If you can't pick up a saw or don't have one,
absolutely. There's a whole gamut. There's money in that law for federal management of federal fuels on federal ground, but there are also all sorts of grants available for people to apply to use authorities that are out there to help manage fuels off the federal landscape as well, because we need to treat all the fuels that are hazardous, not just those that are out on federal lands.
And there's also a wonderful checklist that help you get through cleanup to make it a lot easier. So simple weekend cleaning up, raking around, cleaning out your brush. So simple steps work a lot faster. And they have Wildfire Awareness Week in May. And so that also helps too as well. So there's a lot of resources out there. Just do a lot of Googling.
Yeah. Google FireWise and it'll show you a lot of different resources for that. Okay. Just changing gear here, we're talking about transforming our workforce, but along those lines, the BLM and a lot of other federal agencies are working to ensure more livable wage for all wildland fire personnel. Can you tell us about that and why it's so important?
Yes. So this is funny. It seems like the world has shifted so much. Let me tell a story. So my wife's a baker. She's got a small bakery. Well, she just sold it. She sold it the day that COVID hit this 2 years ago. But she had a small bakery, and she used to talk about having to pay people $12 or $13. This is in Boise, Idaho, so the wages were fairly low here, and she was paying people $12 or $13 an hour, which seemed crazy. Wow, $13 an hour. So this is just a couple of years ago now, and of course, what we've seen is with people leaving the workforce, wages have pushed up. People are having to pay a lot more. So let me say that federal entry-level wages for our base-level firefighters, these are people now who are risking life and limb and leaving their families for months on end, many of them were being paid less than $15 an hour for starters. You can walk around any block in America and see, any fast food restaurant paying more than that. And people are living a much more structured and a much more structured lifestyle, right? So you know that you're going to work 9 to 5 and you're going to get off.
Yeah, they're scheduled.
You can go to the lake. You can see your spouse. You can see your boyfriend, your girlfriend, and et cetera, et cetera. And you got Wi-Fi 24/7. So we don't offer that. We offer an opportunity to sleep in the dirt, to do something incredibly awesome, right? But to spend time away from friends, to spend your summer off in the woods and not on the lake. Very few vacation days, and then we lay you off in the wintertime, right? So this is what we offered, and we trusted that people would just get it in their blood, and it would be so exciting that they would do it. Well, that's fine, but we were expecting people to do that for a wage that's less than the going wage out there. So last year we were super excited that President Biden came to the fire center, and they announced the administration announced that we were going to make sure that everybody got at least $15 an hour for entry level wage. I mean, it seems. It was only 8 months ago, right? It seems like almost a lifetime ago, because now everybody's paying, $15 to $25 an hour just to try to fill their jobs. So we're trying to keep up. We're trying to keep up with the rest of society, realizing that there are not enough workers and there are too many open jobs, and ours are right there along the lines of the trucking industry or the farming industry. I mean, you name it. There are all sorts of industries, especially those industries that are dependent on young folks who've got strong backs and, you know, can do physical work, because our job is really physical. We're having to pay better wages, frankly. We have to offer better benefits, pay better wages, because we are asking a lot of people, and we want to attract the best and the brightest to this job. We want incredible people who are incredibly committed to the job, who can put up with privation and you know, smoke and dirt and dust and discomfort and danger. So we're asking a lot of people, so we need to pay them better, and we're falling behind, frankly. You know, we're just unable to keep up with the private sector. So we're doing our best to pay people what they deserve for this really incredibly stressful job.
You're making it sound so attractive.
I know. Hey, it's awesome. The three of us are here because we absolutely love it. But I think counting on people to give up a lot because it's such a great job, yeah, that works to a certain point. But you also want to pay them well, right? So we want them in there for the long haul. The people who are really great have been around 6, 7, 8 years and have seen a lot of things. They've seen the big fires. They've seen the big fires in California. And we don't want those people then to give up their job and go do something else. We want to keep them in the job for 15, 20 years, because the longer they do it, the better off we are, because they've got more slides in their head. They've seen more. They can make better decisions. They can save, you know, your cabin, my life, my kids' lives, because they make good decisions. Those are the people we want to keep in the industry. We want to keep in the business. We can trust that they fall in love with it. But we also need to pay them to keep them on board, because it's unfair to say, yeah, just do it for the love of the game. Doesn't work all the time. It works with some of us, but not everybody. So
yeah, you can't entice them with awesome views and eating MREs like you used to.
Yeah, well, we've all seen things we would never see. Correct. In another job, and it is it's the best job ever. Yeah. I mean, I've been to places that I would never have seen in my lifetime. Yeah. You know, got to do it professionally, you know. Yep. It's, look, I'm getting paid to be up here on this mountaintop. I mean, that's incredible. And you can't do that working for Chick-fil-A. Sorry, Chick-fil-A, but you do not offer the views, the spectacular views. You're not going to wake up, roll out of your sleeping bag at the top of a mountain and see across a valley the way we get to in this job. So that's phenomenal. We just want to pay them alongside, paying them with those amazing views.
Yeah. And it seems like a lot of people have been getting outdoors, especially during the pandemic, and enjoying outdoors. So for all you people out there who want that job outdoors, this is an opportunity.
Absolutely. People want to make a difference and want something that's unconventional. So I'm in this job. My dad was a white collar guy, you know, worked for corporate America. My mom worked in a store and sold lingerie in China. all well and good, but I wanted something different. I didn't want to wear a suit and tie. Now I do have a tie in my office, and I do have to wear it sometimes, but generally not. But no, I swore I wasn't going to wear a suit and tie. It was like, I didn't want to be inside my whole life. And so I chose a job that kept me outside as much as possible. Now I did change gears a little bit when I got a little bit older, but there's an appeal to that. And there's an appeal to doing something that's so important that the nation and the world needs more than ever. So absolutely. It's the best job in the world. You know, bar none. I would never change one thing that I did in my life.
Yeah, I would agree to that for sure.
Yeah, and there's a lot of opportunity from fire to go into different areas of management.
Yeah. And we talk about sleeping in the dirt and digging line and all that stuff, but we have so many jobs in fire that aren't that. We need GIS people. We need budgeteers. We need accountants. We need HR specialists. We need the gamut. So there is a lot of fire operational stuff that happens out there in the dirt, but there's a lot of other stuff that goes on in our industry that isn't that. And so all comers, we encourage all skill sets. We need them all. There's no part of human experience that we don't treasure in some way in the fire community. So we got a place for pretty much everybody in the fire world.
Right. And that's what makes it so great.
Yeah, it's one of them. It's one of those things.
One of those things. So, coming to our one of these questions that we get asked all the time about this time of year, speaking of all these people we need to hire for fire year as we come into the heavy season, starting probably around May in some areas of the West and Southwest, what is your best guess at this point what fire season's going to look like, or fire year is going to look like this year?
I don't think nobody spooled me up with that question. So this is a classic question we get this time of year.
Why is it so hard then?
Why is it so hard?
To estimate.
Well, I can always say it's going to burn in California this year, because California always burns, right? It's a Mediterranean climate, and California is going to have some kind of fire season regardless. It's hard to predict. We can tell a lot about patterns of drought and where the fuels are dry, but here's a great example. The last couple of years have been incredibly dry in the West, and we in the BLM, we manage a lot of rangeland for the American people, right? And rangeland like in Southwest Idaho, in Southeast Oregon, and Nevada, and bone dry the last couple of years. And you would think, my gosh, you know, the Great Basin states where we manage a lot of fires, those are going to burn like crazy. Last few years, they've hardly burned at all. One of the reasons is because it's been so bone dry that we didn't grow a lot of grass. And so some of those big fires couldn't get going because there wasn't a lot of grass. And many of the grazers who depend on putting their livestock out on public land are hurting because there's not a lot of forage out there. So it's hard to predict sometimes the effect that something that looks like it's going to be a really scary fire season is going to have in a particular place. What we know is that this is a really droughty year. We're having another dry year. Again, everybody who lives in the West knows not a lot of snowpack in a lot of places. Streams, reservoirs look like they're going to be pretty dry, which means the fuels are going to dry out early, which means a lot of the forested fuels, the ones that burn long, these long duration fires that you see on CNN night after night after night, we're going to have a lot of fires up in that kind of high country this year because there isn't a lot of snowpack. That's a given. We know we're going to have a pretty decent fire season in the Southwest, it sure looks like. So there, it's really dry early, dry now. But a lot of what happens in the summer when we have the peak fire season in the West depends on lightning. Human-caused fires are about 80% of the fire workload out there. But in the West, some of our most problematic days are the days where we have lightning storms that come through and start fires in remote places simultaneously across, you know, millions of acres. And those are the days where we're really chasing our tail trying to catch all these new fires. So some of what happens in the summer depends on how lightning comes into the western United States, whether it comes in dry, whether it's widespread, whether it's followed by rain, whether there are already a lot of firefighters out on fire on incidents at the time. So there are a lot of variables that go in there. We've got the supercomputers at Los Alamos trying to figure out that problem. They haven't figured it out yet. It's really difficult to predict lightning and to predict how that lightning is going to come in. We can see it a week in advance during the summer, but here in early March, it's really hard to predict how that's going to roll out. It definitely is going to be a busy fire season. We know that. Peak fire season, let me say. It's going to be a busy fire year. It's always a busy fire year. It's going to be busy. It's going to be in the timber for sure. We got more grass this year, and that's a good thing for people who need grass out on the rangelands. But there's that scenario that I just described about the last couple of years is not going to be so true this year. There's going to be more grass. So we'll have more rangeland fires out there as well this year. One thing people can do besides hardening their house is not start fires. So as you said, everybody's loving the public lands. The best thing about living in the West, in my mind, in a lot of people's minds, is being able to get away from people, right? And go out on Forest Service or go out on state land or go out in BLM land and recreate, go to the Park Service. All that's well and good. We need people to be careful out there, to be careful about where they're driving, especially when there's more grass out there, taking their vehicles, their UTVs, their dirt bikes off-road and starting fires. That's a problem. People who are running their chainsaws for recreation or cutting firewood or for protecting their cabins need to make sure they're not starting fires when they're doing that. So we need people to help us manage those 80% of fires that are caused by humans. Often those are easier to contain, but they are problematic nevertheless, and you don't want to be the one who starts a fire that burns down a community. So we treasure people going out on public lands. We like doing it ourselves, but we all need to be mindful that we're not contributing to the fire workload that firefighters are going to be facing regardless based on lightning that's going to come in. So it's an easy prediction. We're going to have big fires. We have them every year. It's hard to know year to year where they're going to happen. Sometimes it's Western Montana, and Western Montana is the epicenter for fire, and everybody goes there. Sometimes it's the Pacific Northwest. Sometimes it's the California coast. Sometimes it's the foothills in California. We know as a community it's going to hit us somewhere, and it's probably going to hit us a couple somewhere simultaneously. That's kind of what's happening these days. we'll have the Pacific Northwest be fully engaged in fire, and then we'll have Montana go up. And this year looks like it'll be no different. We just can't precisely say where it's going to be and when it's going to be. If we could, I wouldn't be doing this job. I would be as rich as Jeff Bezos, and I would just be dabbling in fire.
Sure. It's a common thing that when you ask that question, they'll be like, ask me in October and November, and I'll tell you how it is.
And I'll tell you why it happened.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
yep,
right.
Yep. I'll tell you why it happened.
Right. But we can expect probably around May when the outlook comes out, when our predictive services puts out the yearly or the outlook for those months that are high fire season during the year. That's a pretty good indicator of what it's going to
be. Exactly. Look like. And our map right now, as you predict, looks like a big red blotch of higher than normal fire danger across the West. We know we're going to have big fires. Even in a moderate fire season, we still have big fires. And so we need to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. That's our mantra. We still hire the same folks. We have the same stuff available. We never look at the season estimate and say, well, look, it looks like a green map. You know, we just won't bother to hire anybody this year. And, you know, we got a summer off. I mean, we never do that. We are always ready. In case it does happen, right? If it doesn't, then everybody says, whew, that was nice. We had kind of a down year, but we haven't had a down year for a while.
We haven't. Yeah. There's always something going on somewhere, it seems like.
True enough.
So that was kind of one of the last questions, too, that I had for you was, in closing, is there anything that people can do to help solve some of our wildland fire management issues and just help with wildfire managing? And I think you talked about...
We talked about a couple, right?
Yeah.
So don't start fires.
Don't start fires.
Except unless it's in a ring. Follow the regulations. So look to see what your state government, what your local government, what the federal government is saying about fire restrictions and obey them. So if they're saying don't go into the backwoods and start a fire right now because it's really extremely dry, then please listen to that because it's not something we do lightly. That's the last possible thing that people do because we want people to go out and enjoy the woods, right? But when people say... don't have a fire outside of an established campground, they mean it.
And there's a reason. Yeah.
There's a reason. It's a good reason. Not just to be the man. You know, it's not us wanting to throw our weight around. It's like, we do not need extra fires. Please help us out. Don't go out doing a gender reveal, you know, shoot on the grasslands. You know, I'm sorry to say, but it's like people do silly things for good reasons, right? And it seems fun. What could possibly go wrong? I'll tell you what could go wrong. You could end up burning down communities, and you don't want to be the person who's having to face the community that got burned down and say, oh, you know, I just thought it would be cool to shoot some bottle rockets here, you know, out my back porch. So some of it seems like common sense, but, you know, people do things like people will. So, but if you could think about it ahead of time, please don't do it. Or caution that person who's next to you to say, hey, you know what, that's maybe not a great idea. So that's good. Harden your house. Have some understanding. So people out there, firefighters from all walks of life, some of them are just, you know, people who work in the cities. You know, we got all sorts of folks who are out there helping fight fire. They're risking their lives and limbs, and they're giving up their free time to come manage fires. Everybody's doing their best, so some understanding. Understand that if you've got a fire near you and it's maybe smoking out your community, we're doing our best. Out there as a wildland fire community across all walks of life, we're doing our best to keep your community from being smoked out, but there are probably 50 other fires that we're trying to manage at the same time. So I think all of us having realistic expectations of what we can do about fire, about having to live with fire, because we all have to live with fire. Boise, Idaho is a great example. We don't get fires too much, you know, right close to town, but we live with the smoke from the Pacific Northwest or from California all summer long. It's part of living in the West. And it's not a great situation we're in right now, but we're all going to get through it together. But people have to be understanding that it's a long-term problem. It didn't get created in 1 year or 2 years. It's not anything we're going to fix in one election cycle. This is a generational thing that we're doing. We're investing in a generational response. It's kind of like climate change. We can make a change over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but you can't just snap your fingers and say we're not going to have any fires that are problematic anymore. It's a big investment, and we're all going to get through it, and we're going to leave a landscape better for our kids and our grandkids than we've had, but it is going to take some time.
Right. That's what it's going to take, yeah. Some time.
And everyone's help.
Yes.
And everyone's help.
So So anything to say in closing?
No, I just thank you so much for having me. It's been delightful.
Thanks.
My biggest pleasure is working with people like you too. So so that's the great part about this job, in addition to rolling out of a sleeping bag and having a great view.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Grant, for joining us today for our very first ever Wildfire Matters podcast. And we appreciate your insight and all you do and what wildland and fire management agencies are doing to tackle the ever-growing threat of wildfire in the nation. Thanks for listening, and please join us next time when we spark a conversation with one of our fuels management specialists to talk about programs we implement to reduce wildfire risk on our public lands. Yes, and of course, to learn more about NFSI or the BLM, please visit our website at www.nifc.gov. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for topics, questions directly for Grant, maybe he didn't answer everything you wanted to hear, please email them to us. There is on our website, if you go to the contact page, you find the email, because this is kind of a long one, BLM_FA_NIFC_comments@BLM.gov. So it might be better just to go to the website and look for that. If you do have specific questions for our podcast, just put that in the subject line, Wildfire Matters Podcast. And thank you for listening. Until next time, stay safe and be wildfire aware.
To learn more about our fire program, follow us at BLM Fire on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are BLM Fire.